Reynolds Journalism Institute at the Missouri School of Journalism. Welcome to Global Journalist. I'm Jason McClure. Earlier this year, the World Health Organization declared that the Ebola epidemic in the West African nation of Liberia was officially over. The outbreak began back in 2014 and infected more than 28,000 people and killed more than 11,000, almost all in Liberia and the neighboring countries of Guinea and Sierra Leone. But though the immediate crisis may have passed, Liberia still faces huge challenges in recovering. Two devastating civil wars in the last 30 years destroyed much of Liberia's infrastructure, and it ranks as one of the poorest countries in the world. Now, at the start of the outbreak, some hospitals even lacked running water, and the country had just 50 doctors for more than 4 million people. In a moment, we're going to hear more about how Liberia is recovering from the epidemic from a panel of experts. But first, we're going to learn more about how medical researchers and aid groups are trying to head off the next Ebola crisis and what they've learned from recent mistakes. Joining us to talk about this from Boston is Dr. Adam Levine. He's the director of the Ebola Research Team with International Medical Corps. Adam, welcome to Global Journalist.
Thank you, Jason. It's great to be here.
As I understand, Ebola presents a lot of challenges for researchers. People can be carriers of the virus and transmit it before they show obvious signs of sickness. It can be transmitted sexually through bodily fluids like saliva or sweat. What are some of the most promising medical tools that are being developed to deal with it now?
Well, there's a number of different tools that we've been working on, both during the epidemic and now afterwards. One of the most challenging parts of it is diagnosing the disease to start with, because many of the symptoms of Ebola are similar to symptoms of lots of other different types of infectious diseases that are common in resource-limited settings. So we're working on developing new clinical tools that clinicians in the field can use to separate out Ebola patients from those who have other diseases. Also, there's been work on new rapid diagnostic testing that can be used quickly in the field to test which patients have Ebola and which patients don't. And then on the flip side, we're also working on developing new treatments and vaccines for the disease. There's been a lot of work, especially put towards development of a new drug called ZMapp, which we were able to show in a study that we conducted with the National Institute of Health in Liberia and Sierra Leone, that it could be effective in terms of treating patients with the disease. And that's really exciting because when we entered the epidemic, there was not a single drug treatment for Ebola virus disease.
You've been involved with this drug called the development of ZMapp, if you will. How did that drug work? I understand you were actually testing it during the crisis and trying to document how effective it was then. How did you do that?
Yeah, so it was actually very difficult and complicated. Carrying out a randomized controlled trial in the setting of a major humanitarian emergency presents a number of logistical challenges. We worked closely with our partners at the National Institute of Health, which was organizing the study, to figure out how we could integrate it into our clinical operations at three of our Ebola treatment units in Sierra Leone. And we worked closely with them to cover the logistical burdens that were necessary in order to carry out the study. And we were actually able to enroll about a third of the patients that were enrolled in the study at our facilities in Sierra Leone. We were able to carry it out and collect high quality data and then show afterwards when the data was analyzed that actually patients who received the drug had lower mortality than those who didn't. And that's really exciting because it's the first time that we've been able to show that any treatment actually reduces mortality for Ebola virus disease.
And what do we know about exactly how this outbreak began? Is there any reason for concern that there will be a recurrence in the near future?
Well, absolutely. So there have been more than a dozen Ebola outbreaks in sub-Saharan Africa over the last few decades. And we know that the virus continues to exist in an animal reservoir, particularly in bats, we think, in the forests of sub-Saharan Africa. And so it is very likely, because the virus continues to persist in that animal reservoir, that it will again pass into humans. The real question is, the next time it happens, are we going to be prepared to handle it better than we were this last time? And that preparedness really begins on the ground in ensuring that physicians and nurses working in West Africa and across sub-Saharan Africa are trained well enough to recognize the disease and to immediately implement procedures to isolate patients and manage patients so as to prevent the spread of disease in the future.
And your group, International Medical Corps, was one of the first aid groups to send medical staff to Liberia back in 2014. But there has been a lot of criticism about how the international community, especially the World Health Organization, responded to this outbreak. What can you tell us about that? What mistakes were made?
Well, I think there were a couple mistakes that were made. Firstly, initially, when the outbreak was first detected in March of 2014, the assumption was that it would only be a local problem, as all prior outbreaks had been, affecting only the village where it started in, maybe a few surrounding villages. And we were unprepared for the fact that it rapidly spread to major urban centers in Sierra Leone and Guinea and Liberia. The second part of the problem, though, was the lag time for organizations to be trained up in order to learn how to respond to the Ebola outbreak. Ebola is a very complicated disease to manage, much more than many other types of pathogens. And before this outbreak, only one organization, Doctors Without Borders, had ever responded to Ebola outbreaks in the past. They did respond to this outbreak, but quickly became overwhelmed and called for other organizations such as ours, International Medical Corps, to come help. But our organization had never responded to an Ebola outbreak before, and it took us time to train our staff, to develop our protocols, and to set up the logistical systems to be able to manage this disease. And it was that lag time, really, that unfortunately allowed the epidemic to grow much more than it would have. Now, one of the things we need to prepare for in the future is to have better preparations in place in order to be able to respond to whether it be an Ebola epidemic or any type of new emerging infectious disease, so that we don't have that same lag time and we can respond much more quickly.
And when there is a big crisis like the Ebola outbreak, there is often a lot of aid, a surge of interest in sort of halting the emergency. And then afterwards, after the emergency passes, that type of funding and attention often goes away. You know, since the Ebola outbreak, there's been a Zika outbreak in the Western Hemisphere. There's even been a yellow fever epidemic in Central Africa. Is there still a focus on supporting projects to head off the next Ebola outbreak, or has the attention shifted?
Well, that's a hugely important point that you bring up. Right now, International Medical Corps is working in Liberia to develop epidemic preparedness plans for future Ebola epidemics and also for future epidemics of any emerging infectious disease. So we've been working with the local county health teams and with the Ministry of Health and Social Welfare in Liberia to try and ensure that both health workers and health systems are in place and set up so the next epidemic can be detected and managed much more quickly. But the funding for this type of work is definitely starting to dry up, especially as we move farther away from the Ebola epidemic. And that's a real problem, because part of the goal for responding to epidemics is ensuring that you have the infrastructure in place before the epidemic occurs. Once the epidemic occurs, as we learned, it takes a lot of time to catch up if you're not ready beforehand.
Adam Levine, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
A reminder that you're listening to Global Journalist. I'm Jason McClure. Today we're talking about Liberia's efforts to recover from the devastating Ebola outbreak that began more than 2 years ago and killed more than 4,800 people. Now, to hear more about the lasting impact in Liberia and how the country is trying to head off the next Ebola outbreak, we've got three other people who have been following this issue closely. Joining us from the Liberian capital, Monrovia, is Zila Zeze, a public health specialist with the aid groups Effect, Hope, and MAP International. In Dakar, Senegal, is Kieran Gilbert, the West Africa correspondent for the Thomson Reuters Foundation, a news agency that covers humanitarian news. And in Adelphi, Maryland, is Wade Williams. She's a Liberian journalist who covered the epidemic for the news site Front Page Africa. Welcome to all of you. Let me start with you, Zila Zeze. I understand that you worked as a nurse during the outbreak and you do public health work around these issues. Now, what changes have you seen in the Liberian healthcare system over the past couple of years?
There are multiple changes that have been seen within the healthcare delivery system, having learned lots of lessons during the Ebola outbreak. One of them is that there is huge community or in the household ownership of health, as previously seen before Ebola. At this time in Liberia, at many households, individuals are carefully reporting signs of illnesses that they probably may not know what it is. Another thing we have seen is that at the schools, there are screenings going on for early signs of illnesses, and these signs are reported to health facilities. That is helping to keep the kids in school quite healthy, not only against Ebola, but against all the infectious diseases. We've seen that increase confidence in the healthcare delivery system and a reduction in myth surrounding health. And that is helping to increase hospital attendances. And so people are accessing healthcare much better. One other area in which we are seeing lots of improvement is the area of the development of new policies and procedures and guidelines within the health system. One of the new plans the Ministry of Health has come up with is the integrated case management for neglected tropical diseases. So there are lots of new innovations that are coming up, and collectively, as the Ministry of Health is implementing these new policies and plans, the entire health system will become well-strengthened, and that means that we'll be better able to control Ebola should it reoccur, but not just only Ebola. The general population will be ready and much improved to respond to any other emergency.
And Zila, I'm going to come back to some of these changes as well, but I wanted to turn this to Kieran Gilbert to give us just your perspective. We heard Adam Levine talking about the initial response to the Ebola outbreak. What's your perspective on why it took so long to contain the outbreak? What were some of the errors that were made?
I think a lot of aid agencies criticize the World Health Organization for being too slow to react. They say that at the start of the outbreak, there was a lack of leadership. The top WHO officials weren't at high-profile meetings. There wasn't an agency, a representative there at the time. And I think it was a difficult one for the WHO because it's always a fine balance between trying to contain an outbreak like this but not cause unnecessary alarm and to damage an economy of a country. But interestingly enough, the WHO is often considered one of the more politicized UN agencies. And interestingly enough, its Africa office, Africa Bureau, the director of that, is chosen by African governments. And also, this bureau often uses local funds. So it has its autonomy from Geneva. So that also may have been a factor in the delayed response.
And so, in other words, you're saying that there may have been some political pressure on the WHO not to declare this as sort of a world health emergency early on.
Exactly. I think that's exactly the case, that the countries in the region would have been very wary of raising an unnecessary alarm. I mean, in hindsight, they were proved wrong, but I think that was the major factor at the time.
And Wade Williams, at the time of the outbreak, there were a number of stories about the U.S. and other countries giving medical aid and building clinics. And the idea with some of this aid was that the infrastructure that was developed, the clinics that were built, would outlast the Ebola outbreak. To what degree has the aid that has been given, is it still being utilized? Is it still being used effectively?
Well, I think a lot of the aid, you know, that was given by foreign governments were sort of like emergency to tackle the disease, you know, as it was in 2014. And most of these hospitals, you know, and triage that were set up, they were all makeshift, you know, stuff that were set up. So there was nothing, you know, sustainable that you can point to, you know, that was left in Liberia by foreign governments, including the United States of America. I remember the clinic that was set up to treat health workers was also a makeshift one, which was also taken out of Liberia, and that particular clinic didn't really treat a lot of people, you know, because the disease was already winding down before that was established. So I think a lot was missed, and we saw also money being diverted, you know, from Ebola to treat Zika virus. So I don't know what was left, you know, on the ground in Liberia to be any kind of sustainable help to the health.
Well, Zila Zeze, let me turn this to you then, because during the outbreak, there was, of course, treatment, and there was a lot of public education about doing things like hand washing, treatment of bodies at funerals, separating sick people from others, these types of efforts. Are you seeing that some of these changes, are they being sustained on the ground in Liberia?
Some of the changes in behavior are still ongoing in some sectors, But then in some other areas, people are relinquishing these good practices that they did assume during the Ebola outbreak. So at some offices, people are no more washing hands. People are no more testing body temperatures of people before interactions. We are seeing people shaking hands again. Some people have returned to the eating of bush meat and so forth. So, but what is most important is that there is a need for continual education, continual public interventions to help these people maintain the practices that led to the reduction of Ebola. And that is one of the things we are doing with working with the Ministry of Health. And we are confident that we, as partners and international community, needs to continue to support Liberia so that these behaviors become a part of the people. But I'm afraid if we do not keep on reinforcing these behaviors and helping them to address barriers to taking action, we might just very soon lose the many gains that we have made.
And Kieran Gilbert, you did a report earlier this year on a hospital called Redemption Hospital in Monrovia, which was at the center of efforts to treat people during the outbreak. It was basically overwhelmed by the number of patients. They had multiple, you know, two people to a bed, things like that, people on the floor, reports that there was no running water. What did you see that has changed since then?
I think what struck me is speaking to the hospital director, and he said that when Ebola struck in June 2014, that the hospital was just overwhelmed. They refused to turn patients away. But you had two or three patients to a bed. You had a sporadic running water, no protective equipment. So the hospital, ironically, was an incubator for the disease. So it shut down. It reopened then in January last year with a host of infection prevention measures, with a triage unit, with fewer beds, with protective equipment, all the staff well trained. So when I visited, I saw this hospital, which had introduced these improvements, but it was still really a hospital in transition. It was running on a generator because power is unreliable, and there was boxes of clutter everywhere, walking down corridors, even in the wards themselves, where, you know, the doctors were on top of the situation, everything was under control, but the fact that there were still boxes of gloves and equipment not properly stored showed that it's not an easy situation to be in or to deal with when you have such short time to make such huge changes.
A reminder that you are tuned in to Global Journalist. I'm Jason McClure. We're talking today about efforts in Liberia to recover from the devastating Ebola outbreak that began in 2014. We're joined by Zila Zeze, a public health specialist in the Liberian capital, Monrovia, by Kieran Gilbert, a West Africa correspondent for the Thomson Reuters Foundation in Dakar, Senegal, and by Wade Williams, a Liberian journalist who joins us today from outside Washington, D.C. For more Global Journalist content, you can visit our website, globaljournalist.org. There you'll find our ongoing coverage of underreported international issues and human rights violations. You can also check out Global Journalist on Facebook or Twitter, or subscribe to the videocast of this program on YouTube. Wade Williams, give us just a sense of what the general mood of the public in Liberia is now about Ebola. Is there still a lot of concern that this could reoccur, or have people sort of put it aside?
Well, I've been out of Liberia for almost a year now, so I wouldn't be able to sort of like gauge the perception on the ground as it relates to Ebola. But based on reports out of Liberia about the economic situation, and recently the Minister of Finance said that Liberia will need $1.3 billion to recover, you know, from all the economic deficits that the country is facing. And the country now currently has over $500 million for the whole budget for 2016-2017. And the health sector, they only allocated $77 million for the health sector. And that's like nothing because...
I'm sorry, Wade, we lost your audio there just for a moment. But let me turn this back to you, Zila Zeze. One issue, as I understand, is that the survivors of Ebola, the people who lived through it, they face a lot of stigma in Liberia. How does this play out? What sorts of problems do they face?
Many Liberians still do believe that Ebola could reoccur again. And many Liberians have come to understand that the Ebola virus remains in the semen and bodily fluids of survivors. The duration of time it takes to wear off, many of the people in the general public do not know that kind of information. So that leads to the kind of stigmatization and fear of Ebola survivors. There are many of them who have been well reunited with their families and people are getting along with them, but there still remain a significant number of people who are still being ostracized. There are a couple of them. One of them who currently works for the Ebola Survivors Network, she has to live far away from her family and the community in which she previously lived because the community blames her family for introducing Ebola into their community, leading to the many deaths. So there are still a couple of them who are still facing the stigmatization, the discrimination, and are still being ostracized in society.
And Kieran Gilbert, you've written about some of the long-term effects of trauma on people in Liberia as a result of this. And of course, Liberians, many of them have lived through, if not one, two really devastating civil wars as well. Can you tell us just a little bit about how that has had an effect on Liberian society?
A lot of mental health experts were saying to me that the problem in Liberia is that there was already a mental health crisis in 2003 after 14 years of civil war, that more than half of the population were displaying symptoms of depression, post-traumatic stress disorder. But the problem is that for many West African nations, mental health is at the bottom of the list of priorities. For example, Liberia didn't introduce a mental health policy until 2009. And even now, it spends less than 1% of its health budget on mental health. There is one mental health facility and just one or two psychiatrists for a population of 4.3 million. What NGOs are doing now is they are training mental health clinicians and health workers with some basic psychosocial support services. But the problem is it's not really enough, and I think now the race is on to improve mental health in the country because it can have a really debilitating effect on a country. What's really interesting is the World Economic Forum estimates that mental illness will cost the global economy $16 trillion in lost output by 2030, more than perhaps by non-communicable diseases like cancer, cardiovascular disease, and diabetes. And yeah, I still think that mental health is neglected, not just by governments, but it's not understood properly by the population either.
And Wade Williams, we'll try your line once again. You've talked in the past about people in Liberia having sort of a lack of faith in their healthcare system. I understand there's a large hospital in Monrovia called JFK Hospital that came to be nicknamed just for killing. So where did you see the shortcomings, and do you see that people are recovering some of that faith?
I don't think the people are recovering any faith in JFK because recently there was a damning report that came out of the press in Liberia where JFK was accused, you know, of manhandling, you know, patients and not taking care of, you know, patients as they should. And I think the problem of JFK is also stems from the whole problem of corruption in government. When you find, you know, public people who hold public offices are not accountable, you know, to the people they serve. People take money, you know, from government coffers. They are never brought to account for it. And this whole culture is on and on, and that's having a great impact on what should be delivered, like basic social services, you know, like healthcare, basic running water. The issue of corruption and impunity is having an effect on how government properly delivers on the, you know, basic services to their people.
And Zila Zeze, there were a lot of myths and misconceptions about Ebola during the outbreak a couple years ago. What were some of those, and do they still persist today?
There were lots of myths surrounding Ebola. some people did believe that Ebola was being caused by people intentionally poisoning whales. And some people did believe that there are some traditional nuts that we do have in our forest. People believe that eating them were cues to Ebola. Those myths generally have been dispelled in the population because through the hard way, people realized how Ebola ravaged their families and they realized that the myths were actually not true. A bulk of them definitely have been dispelled within the population, and that has helped to contribute to the gains that we have already made against Ebola, because people do believe that Ebola is a medical condition and that it can be controlled through good personal hygiene, the reporting of early signs and symptoms.
And Kieran Gilbert, you've covered humanitarian issues all throughout West Africa. There are a lot of other areas of concern in the region besides Ebola, Boko Haram in Nigeria. There's obviously a migration crisis as well. Where does this still rank in terms of sort of the international community, priorities, the priorities for regional governments?
It's a good question. I think it's a difficult time. I think at the moment there is what aid agencies would call a gray area between emergency funding and longer term development aid. So it's frustrating for many of them because the changes they've made, you know, health facilities now having staff well trained in infection prevention control measures, have protective equipment, they have running water. But that, a lot of that was funded by emergency funding. There's some $6 billion was pledged across the three countries, Liberia, Sierra Leone, and Guinea. But now it's waiting for that money to arrive. Oxfam earlier this year criticized the slow pace of the money, saying that $1.9 billion in recovery funds had not yet been allocated and that there was no word on the remaining $4 billion. So I think now there is that gap between emergency funding and then the transition to the longer-term development.
And our time does grow short, Kieran, but are you optimistic that we're better prepared for the next outbreak?
Certainly. I think the main issue now is the vigilance. I think, you know, in the recent flare-ups, the issues were that in Liberia and Sierra Leone, that the two Ebola patients were treated by health staff who weren't wearing the protective equipment. And also you have communities now who are burying the dead again by touching the dead, you know, washing the body, these traditions that they stamped out during Ebola to stop the spread, eating bushmeat. So I think the main focus now has to be for both health workers and people of these three countries is to maintain that vigilance.
That's going to have to do it for this edition of Global Journalist, a production of the Missouri School of Journalism and KBIA, Mid-Missouri Public Radio. Many thanks to Adam Levine, Zila Zeze, Kieran Gilbert, and Wade Williams for joining us. Our assistant producers this week are Anna Suter, Thomas Orihuela, Jonah McCown, and Federico Maccioni. Our supervising producer is Vera Tan, and our visuals editor is Anadil Iftikhar. Pat Akers is audio engineer, and Travis McMillan is our director. For all of us at Global Journalists, I'm Jason McClure. Thanks for tuning in.